Hello, I'm Hope McMath, director of the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens in Jacksonville, Florida, and welcome to the Kummer Podcast. In this episode, we will walk you through our rededicated Betsy and William D. Lovett Gallery, home to the Meissen Collection, and our beautifully redesigned exhibition space. This collection is one of our great treasures. During this episode, you will hear references to particular cases in the Meissen exhibit. We invite you to visit and enjoy this podcast at the new gallery. If this is your first time listening, you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. It's easy to find. Just search Kummer Museum in the iTunes store. You can also find a link to all podcasts on our blog at blog.kummer.org/podcast. I'm here today with Holly Karras, our museum curator, to talk about the Kummer's extensive collection of Meissen porcelain. Recently, the work collection of early porcelain was voted one of our visitors' top picks during our 50 Favorites campaign. The collection is one of our very great treasures. In this episode, we will walk you through our rededicated Betsy and William D. Lovett Gallery, home to the Meissen Collection. During this episode, you will hear references to particular cases in the Meissen exhibit. We invite you to visit and enjoy the podcast in our new gallery. Now, I warn you, this is not a lecture about dishes. Instead, it is a story about passion, power, and yes, porcelain. So let's start at the beginning. Let's find case number one and look at the item labeled number 31, which is a coffee pot. Holly, so tell me, what is it about the Meissen that you find so appealing?
Well, you know, I really like the story behind Meissen. It sounds like a fable, but it's actually true. Once upon a time, there was a king named Augustus the Strong who loved Asian porcelain. None of the scientists in Europe could make porcelain, so Augustus had to spend lots of money to import the porcelain along the Silk Road. One day, he heard about a young scientist named Johann Böttger who claimed he could turn metal into gold. So Augustus sent out his troops and arrested the young scientist, forcing him into prison in a castle in Germany until he could make gold for the king.
Of course, it turns out that Böttger couldn't make gold at all. Augustus the Strong was very angry and was about ready to have Böttger killed when Böttger made what seemed like yet another impossible claim. He told the king that he could make porcelain. Böttger worked with a team of mathematicians and miners, and in 1709, 9 years after his imprisonment began, Böttger notified the king of his first success. He had developed a form of red stoneware like the coffee pot you see in this case. So could you tell us a little bit more about it, Holly?
Well, Böttger stoneware like this coffee pot isn't actually porcelain, but it does represent the first successes of the Meissen manufactory in porcelain production. Because Böttger was a scientist and not an artist, he had to rely on a team of sculptors and artisans to make molds for the forms. Many of these craftsmen were actually goldsmiths, and the forms they created for Meissen were inspired by silverware, just like this coffee pot. On the other hand, the decoration, like the elaborate handle and the fish's head at the bottom of the spout, are actually inspired by Chinese designs. Let's look at an example of one of the earliest pieces of porcelain produced at Meissen, which is also in this case. The first true porcelain pieces made at the Meissen manufactory were created around 1713. This beaker, which is object number 27, is a good example of these early works. The shape and decoration on the beaker is entirely inspired by Chinese white porcelain pieces known as blanc de chine. At this point in porcelain production, Meissen craftsmen weren't able to produce colored decoration, so they instead applied sculptural decoration like these branches. But you know, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Let's move to the beginning of the craze for porcelain.
Please press pause now and move to the case labeled number 2. The exchange of ideas along the Silk Road is beautifully illustrated in this small stand, which is number 17 in this case. It shows the 13th century explorer Marco Polo and Kublai Khan looking at a map of Asia. The route was an overland one across Eastern Europe, over the mountains of Central Asia, and into China. The Silk Road was the main economic route until the advent of sea travel and was an important piece of history documented on a piece of Meissen porcelain.
You know, this is actually one of my favorite pieces in the whole collection. Although scholars are debating whether or not Marco Polo actually ever made it to China, The fact remains that the Silk Road was essential for spreading ideas east to west, but also west to east.
The stand dates to around 1732. Clearly, Meissen artisans had become very proficient at decorating porcelain with multicolored scenes. There's just so much detail in this piece.
Yes, not only is there that central image with Marco Polo and Kublai Khan, but there are also small scenes called reserves around the rim of the stand. Each one of these has small scenes showing Chinese figures drinking tea or playing with their children on these very strange green platforms of grass.
The dramatic gold work was done exclusively by goldsmiths working in Dresden, so any piece that needed gold decoration had to be transported by boat from Meissen to Dresden. The gold was applied with an adhesive and then sent back to Meissen to be fired. And since the gold turned black during the firing process, it had to be transported again, yes, to Dresden, where the goldsmiths would polish it and restore the shine. Although many of the illustrations were based on Chinese figures, the Meissen artists also used European stories in their pieces. Let's look at a teapot decorated with scenes from Aesop's Fables, also located in this case.
The painting on this teapot, which is object number 18, is an illustration of the story of the monkey and the cat. So in the fable, the monkey and the cat were always looking for food. So one day, the monkey sees chestnuts roasting on the fire and says to the cat, "Look, there are chestnuts in that fire. I would gladly get them for us, but you're so much better at this than I am. Why don't you reach your paw into that fire and get out the chestnuts? And while you do that, I'll divide them between us." Well, as I'm sure you can guess, the cat, who was flattered by the monkey's praise, reached his paw into the fire to grab the chestnuts, and while he was busy, the monkey ate all of them without sharing. The moral of the story? Beware of flattery. Not all Meissen porcelain objects illustrate such fantastic stories, but the making of these objects is a story worth hearing. Let's move to case number 6 to learn more about the process and the artist behind the object.
Please press pause now and move to the case labeled number 6. So now we're going to take a closer look at the plate that has the branch patterns on it, labeled number 3 in this case. The decoration here, including the multi-limb branches with scattered flowers and a beautiful butterfly, are all elements derived from Asian porcelain. All of the blue color has been applied under a clear glaze, while the other colors and gold were applied on top of the glaze. So from the worker who formed the plate to the artist who applied the gold, there were a lot of hands that went into this process.
As production at Meissen became more and more advanced and the secrets of color were revealed, the segregation of duties in the factory really became more and more extreme. In order to keep the secrets of porcelain production at Meissen, no one person was knowledgeable about all the steps needed to make a finished piece. So while some workers knew what went into making the paste itself, others worked on the molds, some knew the time and temperature for firing, other craftsmen were solely responsible for gold decoration, and others worked to develop colors and glazing.
So let's put that in perspective. Making porcelain like the Chinese and Japanese were making was really challenging. If it were easy, it wouldn't have taken Europeans almost 1,000 years to figure it out. Think about it. The first porcelain was made in China during the 7th century. Japan started making porcelain about 1616. Craftsmen at Meissen finally got it right in 1713, but they still couldn't figure out how to decorate it with colors. It took nearly 20 years for them to develop only 16 different colors. So even though it sounds like managers at Meissen were going to extremes to protect the secrets of making porcelain, they had good cause to do so. Many royal families throughout Europe, just like Augustus the Strong, collected Asian porcelain. It was very expensive. I mean, we're talking about fragile pieces that had to be transported across Asia and Europe. So for a collector like Augustus, it really was wonderful to be able to make it yourself. And even better for a man like Augustus, if you're the only one in Europe who knows how to make it, it means you can sell it to all the other royal families who like to collect Asian porcelain. Now that's passion and power.
Exactly. And that's why Meissen adopted a logo or a trademark in the 1720s of small cross swords that they placed on the underside of their pieces. The cross swords were actually derived from a motif on Augustus the Strong's coat of arms. But you know, even this mark didn't always help to prevent theft or forgery. In the late 1720s, a French merchant named Le Maire obtained Meissen porcelain and intended to sell them as Asian originals, and he figured out how to remove the cross swords. But of course, he was eventually arrested and later deported out of Germany. Now let's take a closer look at the Ecule and Stand in case number 11 to see different use of color by the Meissen artists.
We forget when we think of the 18th century how the interest in science and the study of the natural world influenced really all art forms, including porcelain. This was a period of intense investigation into the science and classification of species, and many wealthy collectors had their own museums or cabinets of curiosity. The animals in this piece, object number 12, were specimens for study, but the color is really what catches my eye. The yellow of this Ecule and Stand is a result of Johann Horoldt's extensive experiments with color. Turns out yellow was a favorite of Augustus the Strong and was also associated with the Chinese emperor.
You know, Horoldt really was an amazing colorist. He prepared the enamel colors himself and monitored all the firings of all the colors. He began to document his recipes in a book with a very long title. It goes like this: True and correct description of the enamel or fusible colors that I, with God's help, invented and that now are used in the present royal porcelain manufactory, and likewise of the gold and silver, and of how they should be handled. A real mouthful. It seems to me, though, to be a very 18th century type of title. Speaking of words, let's visit one of the few pieces in this collection with an inscription. It's located in case number 12.
Please press pause now and move to the case labeled number 12.
This small tea bowl, number 24 in the case, was created for the Turkish market, thus the choice of Arabic for the text. The inscription reads, Ah, how beautiful! May it taste good to the drinker in the year of the Hegira 1170, which corresponds roughly to 1756 or 1757 in the Western calendar.
The decoration on this bowl is an abstracted vision of a lotus flower and seems actually very contemporary to my eyes. Let's look at another example of floral and botanical design, starting with an onion pattern that appears on a tea caddy in case 14. Please press pause now and move to the case labeled number 14.
A tea caddy is used to store dry tea leaves.
This tea caddy, number 7 in the case, is decorated in what is known as the blue onion pattern.
This pattern was developed in the 1730s at Meissen and was inspired by Asian motifs, including chrysanthemums and pomegranates. However, the Meissen artist confused the pomegranate with an onion, and so they named it the blue onion pattern. Interestingly, Meissen pieces with the blue onion pattern made their way back to Asia, and within several years, Asian firms were producing goods with the same pattern and exporting them back to Europe.
Sounds a little like 6 degrees of separation, or maybe the telephone game.
You know, it really is just like that. You can watch as craftsmen in one place create a pattern, and then artists in another place change it just a little bit and maybe add a few details, and then send it back, where the original artists take a fresh look at it and make some additional modifications. Back and forth and back and forth it goes.
Pieces like this tea caddy really show how far these works can travel, considering that it is now part of a collection at the Kummer Museum in Jacksonville, Florida. All of these pieces were collected by Ralph Wark. Mr. Wark was an American who was born in Germany at the beginning of the 20th century. As a young man, he went to museum exhibitions featuring Meissen porcelain, which at the time was celebrating its 200th year of production. He was inspired to collect, and this tea caddy was the very first piece he ever purchased in 1922. A lot of the items we've talked about so far have mostly been inspired by Asian porcelain, but the Meissen artists also created their own designs. Let's go look at one of the more impressive of these creations and move to case number 15.
This service was created by Johann Horoldt, who's considered to be the master of Meissen porcelain painting. In 1723, he created an important book of patterns called the Schultz Codex. It contained thousands of images that other artists at Meissen copied. Many of the scenes were derived from illustrated travel reports from Asia, but as you'll see, Horoldt usually inserted his own twists.
Well, looking at the decoration on the Queen Marie of Hanover service, the scenes don't look like any travel imagery from Asia I've ever seen. In fact, the figure on this saucer, which is piece number 12 in the case, doesn't even look like they're from Asia.
You're absolutely right. The scenes in the Schultz Codex were inspired by travel illustrations, but they weren't copies of them. Horrell created fanciful scenes with exotic imagery, but none of them could be considered accurate representations of life in either China or Japan. The figure we're looking at on this saucer is actually a portrait of Augustus the Strong, who's seated at his dressing table. Augustus was an avid collector and also commissioned pieces for his personal collection. Let's look at a set of vases, also in case number 15, that was made for his collection.
The imagery on this set of vases looks a lot like the scenes that we just saw in the Queen Marie of Hanover service.
These are also derived from the Schultz Codex, which was created by the artist Johann Horold in 1723. Like the Queen Marie service, this set shows fanciful images of life in Asia, complete with the Emperor and Empress of China, a phoenix, and, my favorite, a flying dragon. The five vases were made to be displayed on a mantelpiece.
We've already noted that this set was made for Augustus the Strong, but if we didn't already know that fact, we could figure it out, because instead of the blue crossed swords that most pieces have, this one has an AR monogram on the underside, standing for Augustus Rex or Augustus the King. So any piece with an A and an R was made exclusively for Augustus, either for his own use or maybe to be given as a diplomatic gift.
Ralph Wark, the collector who gave all these pieces to the comer, first saw this set in 1925 at an auction in Berlin. However, at the time, he didn't have enough money to buy them. And when they came back on the market in 1972, he bought them for 15 times their original asking price.
And aren't we glad he did? We noted before that there were lots of sources of inspiration for the artists at Meissen, everything from Asian ceramics to the Schultz Codex. But artists also used European engravings and illustrations for inspiration. As we've seen, the decoration of Meissen started with sculptural surfaces and then moved into more complicated paintings. So let's go take a look at an object that brings sculpture and painting together in an impressive tour de force.
Look for a liquor barrel on a pedestal along the wall, which is labeled number 16.
This liquor barrel is such a great sculptural piece. It was made by one of the best Meissen sculptors, Johann Kandler. When he arrived at the factory, he actually had no prior experience working with clay. He created a series of small figures and animals, and even whole villages in porcelain.
This is so totally Rococo, with its gold embellishments, its curvy lines, and its lighthearted theatricality. I love the reference to the ancient Greek god of wine, Bacchus, as we see in the figure sitting on top of the barrel. I think it might be the only time I've ever seen Bacchus holding a coffee cup. Usually, it's a glass of wine.
Coffee and tea drinking were really fads among the wealthy during the 18th century, spurred on by trade with China. And Kandler and his assistants produced all of the pieces needed by the fashion-forward collector. Tea cups, tea bowls, tea caddies, teapots, all became more and more elaborate.
Well, if we're going to talk about elaborate, we need to go and see the swan service over there in case number 13.
This swan service, created by the artist Johann Kandler, had more than 3,000 pieces and could be used at a dinner for 100 people. The extensive and opulent service attracted attention throughout Europe and really marked the high point of Meissen tableware. It also represented the desire to create a more unified ensemble of tableware filled with an abundance of matched pieces.
This particular service was created for Count von Bruhl, who was the prime minister to Augustus III and head of the Meissen manufactory at this time. It was meant to be impressive, and it certainly succeeded. Kandler also created services for the Tsar of Russia and for other foreign courts. He produced special commemorative pieces for both anniversaries and other events. I wonder what he would have created for the Kummer Museum today. Holly, thank you so much for walking us through the Meissen collection. In the future, we hope to bring you shows that will guide you through other exhibitions, our permanent collections, and even our gardens. This podcast can be saved and used in the gallery or at home. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast in the iTunes store or on our blog, blog.kummer.org. Thanks for listening. You have reached the end of the tour. If you would like to experience this interactive tour or listen to the audio podcast at home on your tablet or desktop, just visit kummer.org/Meissen. That's M-E-I-S-S-E-N.